Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, where the man considered to be one of our greatest presidents has been celebrated so often for his achievements in his first term. His name is John F. Kennedy. And, of course, he was elected at the age of 43 and then had a great and eventful and significant first term. But why is it that until now we've had no books at all about Kennedy's second term? Answer, because it didn't happen. He got killed. But what if he had lived? That's the question that Jeff Greenfield asks in the first ever history of John F. Kennedy's second term. The book is called If Kennedy Lived, The First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy. And nobody better than Jeff Greenfield to write this book. He is a five-time Emmy Award-winning analyst. He's been a correspondent for CBS, ABC, CNN, and PBS. He just can't sit still when it comes to working for prestigious television networks. A columnist for Time. Most importantly, for these purposes, he was a speechwriter for Senator Robert Francis Kennedy, the younger brother of the President of the United States. Jeff, first of all, did you ever personally meet President Kennedy?
I did not. I was in college when he was assassinated. So that was a few years before my time.
Never even went to a speech that he gave or anything like that?
I did. At the University of Wisconsin in my freshman year was the 1960 campaign, and he spoke at the field house. My roommate and I had seats several hundred feet above it. But what I remember, apart from the speech, was that he had a tan. He worked on that in Palm Beach all the time. So nobody had a tan in Wisconsin in October. So even from that distance, you could look down and see this very distinctive, you know, tan face and the sea of pasty white and very occasionally African-American faces. So, yes, that was the one time I heard him. It was quite exciting. That election was the single closest in American history by some measures. The largest turnout ever, because it was very close. It was clearly a passing of the torch. Michael, people forget that, well, you're quite right. John Kennedy was elected at 43, but Richard Nixon, who was always seen as an old man, was all of 47.
Yeah, but he was the older, tired candidate, and Kennedy played on that. The one speech during the campaign, I was in junior high school, and I cut school to go out and see President Kennedy deliver a speech at Horton Plaza in San Diego, California, where we lived at the time. And the one thing that struck me was the one theme that I remembered, and I've gone back and actually listened, because they, of course, taped and recorded the speech. The entire speech was about the other side is tired, they're old, they're stale, and we're going to lead America with vigor, and we're going to get America moving again, and now it's time for youth and energy.
A new generation of leadership. It was not. It was significant that whoever won would replace the Eisenhower, who was at the time the oldest person ever to occupy the White House. And it was a clear signal of a turnover generationally. Eisenhower had led America, the unified effort in Europe, five-star general, and both John Kennedy and Richard Nixon were basically foot soldiers. Kennedy was a lieutenant JG. I can't remember Nixon's exact rank, but they both were, you know, grunts in World War II, and now one of the two of them was going to become commander-in-chief. It was a very consequential election, both in terms of who would lead and the nature of turning over leadership to this younger group. Once Kennedy won, you look at the people around him. You know, his brother was, I think, 31. Ted Sorensen was 31. His whole White House staff were people in their 30s, which is extraordinarily young. And by the way, the First Lady was 31. Which, if you think about that, that's a fairly young age for somebody to be the First Lady of the United States. So I think that's one of the reasons why that campaign stirred so much interest. I don't mean to be suggesting that every American was self-consciously aware, but there was a sense that something was changing.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, first of all, it was our first Catholic nominee, and I just went back recently and listen to President Kennedy's acceptance speech when he won the Democratic nomination in Los Angeles. And one of the first things that he talked about was how people shouldn't judge him based upon his faith.
Yeah, that's very important you mention that, by the way. But he was the second Catholic nominee, first elected, because Al Smith.
Right, of course.
But
and it was it counted against Al Smith.
Yeah, people think the Houston minister speech that he gave toward the end of the campaign was the one time he raised the issue. But you're quite right. Very early, I think one of the first substantive points he makes in that speech is, you know, it's quite clear that the Democratic Party has been willing courageously to, you know, take this step. And he goes into that same argument he would later use and used earlier in West Virginia, that, you know, we have this is nobody should vote for me because I'm a Catholic. Nobody should vote for me because I'm a Catholic.
Right. One of the things that's stunning about that speech, Jeff Greenfield, and I want to get into discussions about the second term that you write about that never actually happened. Because, of course, there's a great deal in your new book. It's posted on our website at michaelmedved.com. The book is called If Kennedy Lived, the First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy. One of the things about that acceptance speech that struck me, and then I went back and looked at other speeches, and it was true of them as well. There are so many references to American history and to British history, which Kennedy knew well.
Yes, there's a line in that speech. You and I are tracking a lot of ways, because I wrote a column a couple of years ago that to read the acceptance speech is to realize how much faith Kennedy placed in the literacy of his listeners.
Exactly,
because he makes a comparison. Because this is Richard Nixon, and he says, and just as you know, the Richard III was the unworthy successor, and just as Richard Cromwell was an unworthy successor to Oliver, so this Richard. Now, you know, the idea of an acceptance speech today by anybody that would reference that kind of literary and historical allusions is inconceivable. His speechwriters, his advisors would say, "Wait, what are you talking about? Nobody will understand this."
No, of course, and it again, so much of that speech would be put out. People would say, wait a minute, well, you've got a problem. You've got this Harvard background. This will remind people that you're of the elite. This is one of the other extraordinary things, is it didn't necessarily count against John Kennedy.
Is true, and I think the other reason for that and for the nature of his speeches that were so loaded with history is he was supposed that one of the criticisms was he was too green, too young, and making those kinds of references and the constant allusions to American history and world history was, I think, a way of saying to skeptics, I may be young, but I know what I'm talking about.
Your book begins in a fascinating way with something that isn't alternative history. It actually happened. Kennedy talking to advisors who had their doubts about choosing Lyndon Johnson as his running mate.
Yeah.
And Kennedy said what?
Well, it was Kenny O'Donnell, who was one of his closest aides, who was furious that Kennedy had picked Johnson after promising that he wouldn't do it. So he demanded to see him. And Kennedy takes him into a bathroom in the hotel so they can have a private conversation. He says, look, you've traveled with me, Kenny. I'm the healthiest candidate for president, which, by the way, was palpably untrue. He said, I'm 43 years old. Nothing's going to happen to me, so the vice president doesn't mean anything. Now, and what's shocking about this is a guy who had almost died in World War II, whose brother had been killed in World War II, his sister had been killed in a plane crash. He'd almost died on the operating table in 1954. He'd almost died in 1947 of a variety of ailments. And he knew his history. You know, he knew seven presidents had died in office. And that very morning, he'd said to Kenny O'Donnell and to his wife, there was somebody with a rifle out there from an office window. There's nothing we can do about that. That was the day he was killed. And yet, the point I was making was even this man, who certainly had his brushes with death, had this notion, this sort of deterministic notion, and how could fate possibly intervene? And that's how some people choose to denigrate the whole idea of alternate history. They say, what happened. And my notion is, people like Michael Beschloss and Doris Goodwin happen to be on my side of this, or I'm on their side, is no. You want to see what you better understand. You have a better understanding of what did happen if you look at how closely we came to a very different history, how tiny twists of fate can lead to consequential major shifts in what did happen. That's why I like to do this stuff.
Well, and you've done it before with your previous book that actually does a number of alternate history scenarios. That book is called Then Everything Changed, the new book, If Kennedy Lived. Let me ask you something, because, Jeff, I don't know the answer to this, but I know that immediately after President Kennedy was killed, people talked about Tecumseh's curse, the idea that every single president elected in a year ending in zero, starting in 1840, had died in office. Is there any evidence that he was at all aware of that? We will get to that and more with Jeff Greenfield, the author of If Kennedy Lived, coming up.
The Michael Medved Show, michaelmedved.com. To purchase this special show, go to medvidhistorystore.com.
21 minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, of all the avalanche of books that have descended upon us concerning the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, the new book, If Kennedy Lived, is one of a kind. It says right before the title, November 22nd, 1963, JFK does not die. What would happen to his life, his presidency, his country, his world? And one of the things that I admire about Jeff Greenfield's new book, it is his latest bestseller. Jeff was an aide to Senator Robert F. Kennedy and later to Mayor John Lindsay, the late Mayor John Lindsay of New York City. And one of the things I admire about the book, Jeff, is you don't make it into a situation where if only Kennedy had lived, we would be living in an Edenic world and everything would be perfect. And but
right.
you do make...
one of the things about this kind of question that I think is the wrong way to answer is, okay, well, if you like John Kennedy, that's right. It all would be well. And if you didn't like his politics or his behavior, then everything would be terrible. We all know that. What I try to do is, just drown, if that's the right word, in the history. Read the oral histories. Read interviews. Read biographies. Try to figure out what as much as you can about, in this case, John Kennedy. And then it's almost like an algorithm. You know, run the facts as we know them through a different character, Kennedy rather than Johnson, and see if you can plausibly reach different conclusions. But look, do I think he would have avoided Vietnam? I do. It's based on probability, not certainty. And there's if you've looked at the book, and it sure sounds like you have, there's a pretty detailed account of why I think that. But he also had a reckless private life. His sexual behavior was, I think the best word for it is nearly pathological and dangerous. You know, taking up with the mistress of a mafia don and giving J. Edgar Hoover the tools with which to blackmail him effectively into staying on that job. So it's not a Valentine. It's not a it's not a knock job. It's saying, on balance, let's try to see how the country might have been different if it had rained, if the rain hadn't let up in Dallas and the bubble top had stayed on the car and Oswald had wounded but not killed him. That's what sets the story in motion.
And speaking of that day on November 22nd, 1963, you have presidents all in a row every 20 years. It's like clockwork. 1840, we elect William Henry Harrison. He dies a month later. He dies in office. 1860, we elect Lincoln. He's shot. 1880, we elect Garfield. He's shot and killed. 1900, we elect McKinley. He's shot and killed. 1920, we elect Warren G. Harding. He dies. 1940, Franklin Roosevelt, he dies after winning his next term. Was Kennedy aware of this pattern, which was so evocative? And then, of course, the president after Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, gets shot in the chest but survives, which breaks the pattern.
Yeah, I can. There's nothing in all the reading that I've done that ever suggests that Kennedy referenced the so-called Tecumseh curse, that he said, Tecumseh said, you stole our land and every president elected in a year and in zero will die. There's plenty of evidence, and I just cited you some earlier, that he often talked about, very fatalistically, about if somebody wanted to get him, they could. There was nothing, look, in 1960, I wrote about this in an earlier book, a suicide bomber parked outside his Palm Beach home came within seconds of killing him before he ever got to be president. And that's, you would think that, that might kind of shake him up enough, but no. And you're right, if John Hinckley had aimed that gun a couple of inches, I guess, to his left, Reagan would not have survived 8 weeks in office, and that curse would have been reaffirmed. But between Reagan and George W. Bush, the last two presidents in the years elected ending in zero have lived, fortunately, and that curse is now, it's kind of like the curse of the Bambino in Boston. It's gone.
Yes, and that's good for all of Red Sox Nation, and the end of Tecumseh's curse is good for all of the United States of America.
On the Billy Goat curse.
That's right, for Chicagoans.
Yeah.
Okay, the book is called If Kennedy Lived. One of the things that is fascinating in the book, as you indicated before, Jeff Greenfield, is you recognize the insane nature of John Kennedy's sex life, which now this is no longer rumors. This is provable. Do you you suggest that there might have even been consequences in his second term to his marriage?
Well, but, that comes under the heading of spoiler because it comes at the very end. But fair enough. You know, the idea that Jacqueline Kennedy didn't know about this is absurd. I mean, we know from plenty of, histories and biographies and memoirs since that she was quite aware of it. But the
how could she not be after
the mystery? Actually, maybe it's not a mystery. Maybe you know, any good shrink could explain this. You look at John Kennedy's behavior during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the fate of the world was at stake, and I'm not exaggerating this. And you see a man guided by prudence and measured steps and a constant concern that he get every piece of information right, that he don't act on miscalculation. And I think, however much you think maybe he shouldn't have gotten into that in the first place or whatever, that was the work of somebody in total control, unlike Johnson, who could often personalize international disputes, especially Vietnam. Kennedy was the most cool and detached of presidents when you wanted that, when the world was hanging in the balance. And this is the same person who just flagrantly disregarded any sense of discretion in how he conducted himself. You know, this was not somebody who, you know, sort of carefully tried to meet somebody under controlled circumstances. You know, bringing women into hotel rooms.
And even in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I don't know the full extent of that, but the point is, it's such a...
It's a huge mystery, but there's a deeper mystery to me, Jeff Greenfield, and in the brief time remaining to us, nobody better, given your experience with the leading news networks in the country. John Kennedy was not universally admired by the press. Yes, the press had a love affair with him, but there was certainly a conservative press. There were certainly conservative press outlets that had it in for the guy. Why did this behavior, how did it happen that it remained so well concealed throughout his presidency?
Yes, but there are a couple of things, and I'll do this quickly. One is that a lot of the press didn't know. Some did, some didn't. It wasn't universally known. The other thing is that most of the press had, at the time, a very clear notion in their heads between what was public and what was private. They just didn't do this. Not to mention the fact that many of the press barons you're talking about had their own feet of clay. but basically, it was a sense of what belonged in the public press. You know, the whole idea of writing about sex back then was kind of weird. You didn't do it. You know, when Time magazine used to have a code, a great and good friend was a man's mistress, and a confirmed bachelor was gay, and a man with an eye for a well-turned ankle was a skirt chaser. So I think there's a combination that you got to remember that they were gatekeepers then. If we'd had Twitter and smartphones and YouTube,
it would have been
all over the place.
The course of history would have been different. That's what the book is about, If Kennedy Lived. Now, Jeff Greenfield may not have an eye for a well-turned ankle, but he has an ear for a well-turned phrase. The book is highly readable, strongly recommended. We will be right back.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
Portions of the money.
34 minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, and part of the fascination of John F. Kennedy is not only the president himself, but very much the people around him. It's one of those things that I was thinking of when I was looking at the magnificent cover for Robert Dallek's new book. Robert Dallek is one of the most admired and distinguished of all American historians, who has written definitive and important books about John Kennedy before, as well as books on President Reagan and President Franklin Roosevelt and President Lyndon Johnson, President Nixon. He is a former president of the Association of American Historians. And Professor Dalek's new book is called Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. Professor Dalek, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, I'm very honored to speak to you, and I'm fascinated by the cover photo because what it shows is President Kennedy's emerging through a door, and he's surrounded by all of these people, many of whom are kind of instantly recognizable to anybody who was alive at that time. There is no other president whose staff, whose cabinet ever emerged into the same celebrity status, is there?
Well, hardly. I think you're right. You know, there were a few people in Franklin Roosevelt's administration, and maybe one or two for Harry Truman, like Dean Acheson. But by and large, people remember Ted Sorensen and Arthur Schlesinger, Dean Rusk, of course, Robert McNamara, and most of all, of course, Robert Kennedy, who was the president's brother and attorney general.
Well, the president's press secretary, Pierre Salinger, was a huge public figure, and he went on to become a United States senator from California.
Quite so. That's right.
And so all of this is extraordinary when you think about it. And the other thing that struck me immediately, looking at this photograph, and it's a whole bunch. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 aides and President Kennedy. All of the aides have a couple of things in common. And the one that you notice from today's perspective is they're all male.
Right.
And they're all white guys.
Yep.
And though females, as you wrote in your previous book, did have a role in the Kennedy White House, not always a wholesome one.
No, quite so. Of course, there was Jacqueline Kennedy, who did emerge more so later as a distinguished public figure, who people admired for her courage during the funeral, her poise, her ability to get through that without breaking down, because she was such a young woman at the time, in her 30s, and had gone through such a searing experience, you know, sitting next to her husband when his brains were blowing out in that horrible incident in Dallas.
You write about Mrs. Kennedy and her role as First Lady, which was considered to be groundbreaking. We had gotten accustomed to First Ladies like Mamie Eisenhower or Bess Truman or even Eleanor Roosevelt, who were not exactly paragons of glamour.
Not at all.
Very worthy and wonderful ladies. And then we had Jacqueline Kennedy, and that was part of the fascination. One of the questions that I would ask, I spoke also to Jeff Greenfield, who has written about President Kennedy. He had no doubt that Jacqueline was aware that President Kennedy was a less than perfect husband.
Yeah, I think that's quite true. And there was one incident when the president and Jacqueline Kennedy were up in Canada, and they were standing in a receiving line, and there was this blonde young woman who was coming through the line, and Jackie was angered and whispered to the president's army aide, military aide, whispered to him in French that she was, it wasn't enough that this woman had to be brought along on a trip, but then she had to be subjected to the humiliation, really, of shaking her hand. And so she knew. But, you know, it was this open secret, at least open among certain people, including people in the press, because when I did my first volume, I interviewed a number of journalists, and I asked them, did you know about Kennedy's compulsive womanizing? And they said, yes, we knew about it. But you didn't write about this in the mainstream press in those days. You know, don't you think a president who tried to do this kind of thing or had this kind of behavior currently would never get away with it?
Okay, now we need to get the answer on that. Would a president get away with it today? Would he get away with the health problems so well concealed? That and more with Professor Robert Dalek coming up.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com. 44
minutes past the hour on the Michael Medved Show, this special broadcast on President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And on the anniversary, marking the anniversary of his assassination 50 years ago, one of the many, many outstanding books, and in many ways the most outstanding of the new crop of books that have come out about President Kennedy, is the book by Professor Robert Dalek, Camelot's Court Inside the Kennedy White House. And Professor Dalek has taught everywhere, Boston University, UCLA for many, many years, Oxford, Columbia, and he is an acclaimed, deservedly acclaimed presidential historian. His book, An Unfinished Life, did groundbreaking research about some of the secrets of the Kennedy administration, not just the womanizing, which people had written about before, but not with such authoritative detail. But particularly the president's health problems. You were mentioning, Professor Dalek, that it would have been impossible to imagine that a president could carry on the way President Kennedy did with women, and that it would remain secret today with the press corps, that the press corps would collaborate with keeping it a secret. Don't you think that's also true regarding President Kennedy's health?
Oh, without question. That with, you know, what I think changed this was Watergate, Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson's credibility gap, the sense that the public had been deceived, misled, and also, of course, the proliferation of so many media outlets with the Internet and Facebook and all these cable channels. Simply no president can get away with this kind of thing. You know, I've had dinner four times with President Obama. He likes to speak to presidential historians. And we talked to him about that, namely not about womanizing, but about the fact that presidents are subjected to this 24/7 news cycle, that there's an unrelenting coverage of every single little thing that a major public figure does. And so it's very much a different world from the 1960s.
Well, it is. If you could just review for people, because I think some of the listeners would still be astonished. President Kennedy seemed to be the picture of vigor, of of energy and robust good health. And people talked about touch football on the White House. If you could just explain to people what fragile health the president really was in.
Yes. Well, as a boy, he had something called spastic colitis. And initially, they didn't have it treated. He was sent to the Mayo Clinic in 1934 when he was 17 years old. And then when he was in college in 1940, he was put on steroids. Actually, it was a little early. I think it was 1937 that they got him onto steroids. Because they first became available, his father was one of the wealthiest men in the country, could afford to buy this medication, and they didn't have a dose. And so they gave him excessive amounts. It did rein in the colitis, but apparently it triggered the Addison's disease, which was the malfunctioning of his adrenal glands. And this is a very serious illness, because if you have a tooth extracted, any kind of surgery, it puts your life at risk if you didn't have the ability to generate adrenaline. And it also produced the back problems. Again, people thought that his football injury and the episode in World War II when his PT boat was cut in half and he swam to an island rescuing his crew. Two men were killed, but he rescued the rest. But in fact, it was the steroids that caused this osteoporosis of the lumbar spine. And he lived with constant pain. And we had the list of medications. My medical colleague who came with me to Boston to study the records, and we could see the extensive number of medications he took. And, you know, I set his medical records and then the medications he was taking down alongside the records of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And what was impressive, and the reason I think to this day people are less censorious about the fact that he hid, covered up his medical problems, the fact that he was able to cope with all of this, but the medications allowed him to perform so effectively during that missile crisis. You don't see him giving any ground, so to speak, to the medical difficulties or the pain and suffering.
Could you mention for folks, Professor Dalek, some of the medications he took on a regular basis?
Well, there were the steroids that he needed for control of the Addison's disease. There were all sorts of painkillers to rein in the difficulties that he had with his back. There were medications for urethritis, prostatitis, sinusitis. And at one point, Jacqueline Kennedy came to his allergist and asked if he could prescribe something that would take the edge off the tensions that the president was living under. And they prescribed something which apparently is a drug. I can't remember the name of it, but it's totally out of use nowadays. But at that point, it was thought of as an antipsychotic or something that controlled anxiety. Now, he was only on that for 3 days. And why they put him on it and why then they took him off it so quickly is difficult to understand and unknowable because there's no record of what they thought. But there were these array of medications. Some of my medical friends told me that they don't know that he would have lived a long life. He had so many health problems that he might not have gotten to be 60 years old or much beyond that.
And which is extraordinary. He was 43 when he was elected. What is amazing to think is that given his very, very serious health problems that Robert Dalek documents in his previous book, An Unfinished Life, is it conceivable that President Kennedy could even have died in office had he not been assassinated, had he been elected to a second term? Why did Kennedy not follow the chief of staff system, have one dominant White House aide, as his predecessor Dwight Eisenhower did? We'll get to that and more with the author of Camelot's Court, Robert Dalek.
The Michael Medved Show, michaelmedved.com. To purchase this special show, go to medvidhistorystore.com.
55 minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show with Robert Dalek, his latest book on John F. Kennedy is called Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. One of the fascinating sections of your book, Professor Dalek, and there are many, suggests the care with which Kennedy established the team that surrounded him. It's what David Halberstam later called somewhat ironically, the best and the brightest, because Halberstam blames them for stumbling into Vietnam. You suggest in the book that President Kennedy might well have avoided the disasters or the challenges of Vietnam. But one of the things that struck me was President Eisenhower, being a military man, had a very clear staff organization. He had one individual for most of his administration, Sherman Adams, former governor of New Hampshire, who was totally in charge at the White House.
Yes.
And President Kennedy avoided that, and yet he had this dazzling array of some very vivid, brilliant personalities surrounding him, people like his special assistant and speechwriter, longtime aide Ted Sorensen, people like Arthur Schlesinger, press aide Pierre Salinger and Kenny O'Donnell, many more. He didn't have a single chief of staff. Why not?
Because he had these people like Dave Powers and Kenny O'Donnell, Larry O'Brien, who had been with him for a long time, and he was very reluctant to favor one over the other. Also, what he really wanted was to have his brother, Robert Kennedy, be the unofficial chief of staff. And indeed, I call one chapter in this new book, Robert Kennedy, I'm trying to remember the name of it now, principal, you know, chief of staff. Or anyway, he was really the chief of staff without the title. And what's missing from the records, and we'll never have them, is the fact that the president, Bobby Kennedy, used to talk all the time. And we don't have written records. We don't have tapes. Of course, there are all sorts of tapes from the Kennedy presidency, but very few of Jack and Bobby speaking behind the scenes. And what we do know
is that some people watch both of them in some of these meetings when Bobby would come down like a ton of bricks on somebody or propose one policy or another, and Kennedy would sit there silent, not even nodding his head, but the assumption was that Bobby was speaking for him because, as Kennedy said when he made his brother attorney general, because people were protesting, how can you make a relative your attorney general? You know, your brother Robert doesn't have much legal experience. And Kennedy joked, well, I want to give him a little legal experience, but...
That's a great way to get it as Attorney General of the United States. The book is called Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House, describing Robert Kennedy as the president's advisor-in-chief, as indeed he was, together serving this greatest nation on God's green earth.